Mr. Collins, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
In South Shields, 2nd of June 1923.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a van driver, and he became, during the war, for Binns, he became the manager of the department for delivering.
Did you go to school in South Shields?
Yes, in Bede's school. And then when I passed the exam, I went to St. Bede's Central.
How old were you when you left school?
I left school when I was 14.
1937?
Seven.
Did you get a job?
Yes. The job was at a place called Crofton's, which was a big store, and I got the job in the store.
What were you doing when war broke out?
When I was still there, at Crofton's, but it was bombed during the war and destroyed. And then went to the ALP, because I was already doing the ALP work from when war started, 39. And I did the ALP work, first aid work, until I joined the army in January of 42. But prior to that, in 36 and 37, I'd been in the Durham Light Infantry Cadets, the 1st Battalion. And I was in 36 and 37.
What did your ARP work involve?
The first aid party, when you went with an ambulance, when the bomb dropped, or whatever it was, you went with an ambulance and they had people recover and pull them out the wreckage and give them first aid, got them to the hospital.
Was there much bombing in South Shields?
Quite a bit. Actually, it was in 1941, about October or something, or September, quite a lot of bombs fell in South Shields. You see, along the other side, the shipyards were always packed with naval vessels, King George the Fifth, all these big were being looked after there, and got several raids, and the big one destroyed practically the whole of the marketplace. It's a big place, marketplace, with bombs all over, hundreds of people killed, and there's areas sheltered underneath. And they say that people were buried in the shelters and just filled in, you know?
Do you think it's true?
It's possibly true. I remember one German bomber was shot down over South Shields, and they came down at the sea, on the seafront. The pilot came out by parachute, one of them anyway. He landed on the trolley bus wires, you know, and then they picked him up down there.
Did you see the plane coming down?
No, I didn't see it at all, no.
Did you go to the marketplace yourself when those bombs
fell? I've been there two or three times, yeah. But I didn't get concerned with helping people, because I was more or less a junior member, you know. I was only 17 at the time. No, 18.
What type of things would you be asked to do?
Well, anything in that respect, to bandage people up. I did first aid. I was in St. John's Ambulance Brigade as well. You learned how to treat fractures, how to treat all sorts of things, you know.
Did you have an ARP uniform?
Oh, yes, an ARP with the badge on. Like a Navy battle dress with a red ARP badge on the left breast.
Was it easy to get into the ARP?
Oh, no bother at all. You see, this, They took some men who were over the age for joining the forces and being called up, and they took them into the ELP. And we were in St Mark's Church Hall, which was made at an ELP post. And there was a two shifts, 12 hours each shift, and there was something like 50 men altogether, 25 in each shift, were there permanently because of air raids, you know, and for anything that happened.
Do you remember the people who were in charge of the South Shields ARP?
The photograph there, oh, that's the one you looked at. I could tell you the names. Bob. Mr. Gardner was the head at the... he worked from the clinic in South Shields, which was the headquarters, you know. I was in St Mark's Church in Hardwick Street, South Shields. That was taken over by the LP and used as a depot, and they kept it analysis in the yard.
Do you think it was an efficient organisation?
Oh yes, I mean, it just had to be.
Do you remember any other places, buildings or streets in South Shields that were hit by bombs?
Yes, yeah. South Eldon Street was hit by a bomb. On Cleeden Hills, they dropped some bombs. And they dropped some at the seafront. And they tried to get what we call River Drive, the big bridge across now. It used to show up in the moonlight, you know. They tried to bomb there, River Drive, and those bombs dropped there, and what we call the Low Top. Those bombs there as well.
What is it called?
The Low Top. LAWETOP, you know, Low Top. Near the seafront.
Did you have any narrow escapes yourself from the bombing?
No, not at all. No.
Did you use the shelters?
No, we didn't have them. You see, you just waited for the call coming if air raid was on. You waited for them to telephone the ring to call the ambulance out or so and so. There wasn't any shelters there.
What was the morale of the public in South Shields like under the bombing?
I think it was very good. I don't think there was any, there was definitely no panic. Everybody just got on with it. You see, with it being such an area, the mines, shipyards, everything was connected there, Armstrong, Vickers, making tanks and shells and bullets. Everything up here was connected with the war effort. And that's all people were interested in. They certainly weren't worried or frightened or anything else.
What did people feel about the German pilots who were carrying out the bombing?
Well, I never really contacted anybody in that respect. The normal thing is to call them all sorts of names, you know. But we knew that they were bombing and we were going to do the same. You know, felt it was just the way, just war.
Do you think that the people would have harmed any of the German pilots if they'd have got hold of them?
I don't think so. No. There'd have been... No, they wouldn't have harmed them at all.
Did Did people listen to the speeches of Churchill?
Oh yes, I listened to Churchill. Of course, you had radios, you know, and they thought Churchill was a great man, no doubt.
Now, how did you come to be in the forces yourself?
Well, in 1942, I was called into, in January 42, the Royal Corps of Signals at Catterick Camp in Yorkshire. And I did my initial training, square bashing, they call it. Did it there.
How were you treated at Catterick?
Oh, very well. You see, we were the youngest lads they'd ever had called in. And we were put in the new, what they call us, Handhurst blocks. Big brick buildings, you know. And we had good food, everything. When they finished the initial training, you got pushed into these pre-war 1940 wooden huts, where you then got sent somewhere else to continue training. But while you were training at Catterick, we were put into these wooden, these brick barracks, which are very good. They even told us they'd been ordered not to swear at us because of you lads.
Did they swear at you?
No.
Did they treat you with kid gloves?
No, not necessarily. But they certainly weren't rough or anything. They're good. It's the home of the Royal Signals, as you know. It always has been.
How did you come to be selected for these signals?
Well, I was selected at my medical. I went for a medical at Newcastle. And they decided what the way it went. I think it depended on what they were looking for at the time. If it was a very short of infantry, I think everybody would push it there, you know. There was three of us. One, two, three. Went from South Shields together.
Who were the other two?
Yeah. A lad called Terry George and a lad called Andy Feetham. Once you're at Catterick and finish your training, you're given an aptitude test, like square pegs and round holes and things like that. And they made their minds up where we were going to go. So some went to wireless operators, some went to smash riders, some went as linemen, some went as drivers. They sort of now went to some places from Catterick. I happened to go to London as a wireless operator.
Whereabouts did you go to in London?
Putney.
This was in March?
Yeah, Putney. The first ESSTB, which is actually the first artillery signal section training battalion. But it was not to do with artillery, you know. It was a barracks of a territorial unit before the war.
What kind of training did you get there in Putney?
A radio operator, a wireless and line, which included electricity and magnetism and battery charging, things like that. And Morse, of course.
What did you think of the quality of the instruction that you got there?
Most of the instructors that we had there were civilians from the big firms, like Marconi, Phillips, I got. They were civilian teachers. Some were in the army, but older ones are civilians. They're good, very good.
Did you have any problems with any of the things that you had to know?
No, you went through various stages. This first one meant you did about 6 or 7 words a minute. You were operator, voice of the line, Group E. As it got a bit better, you took another exam, operator, voice of the line, B3. That's as far as I went there. Once you got B3, you were reckoned to be capable of being an army wireless operator. And we were, I wasn't sent to another unit because that's when I joined the SOE. That's how it happened. The squadron leader came round the classrooms. He said, I'm looking for young lads who are willing to go abroad on temporary duty. You're already home for Christmas and you'll all have a medal.
In what?
You'll all have a medal. And of course, it didn't say it was Christmas.
This was July of 42.
That's when I went, to SOE. I didn't know then with SOE, didn't know what it was at all. No idea.
How many volunteered then?
There was about 8 of us from where I was. And when I got to Henley on Thames, it was SDS 40, SDS 41 or 42, I'm not sure. A special training school. One of these stately houses on the other side, you know. And there were some more there from other places.
And so when you volunteered, you really didn't know what you were letting yourself in for?
No idea.
Do you think you would have volunteered if you had known accurately?
I'm sure I would.
Why?
Well, you see, I've always had the feeling that if you don't volunteer or you don't want to get into something, you never know what you might have missed. You know, anybody can be a stay at home and never, you know, I always wanted to, no matter what anybody asked at any time, I always say yes, okay. Right through my service with the SOE, I volunteered to go here, there and everywhere.
But when you volunteered, did you have an interview to nope. see if you were suitable?
No. We were put straight away training with the radio. That was the main thing.
At Henley?
At Henley on Thames. Fawley Court.
What was Fawley Court like?
Fawley Court was a big house. We were accommodated in the stables. They'd actually built some bunks, things, in the stables. We were accommodated then. We did the training in the main house.
You were accommodated in stables?
Yeah.
Were they bad conditions?
No, they're good. They've been quite all right. They built bunks, wooden bunks and everything, you know.
So you were in a group of 8, were you?
Well, no, there were some more people there, some more lads there. And we were all together then. I think about 2024.
Were they all from the Royal Corps of Signals?
Yes, they were then, that I knew of, because they were all operators, you see.
How different was the training at Henley on Thames from what you'd had in...
Terrific. You see, we're trained by 2 coloured operators. One was called Sergeant Eddie Case. And the one was called Corporal Davy Lewis. They are both from Trinidad. They were brought over from the Post and Telegraph Service of Trinidad to teach, and they taught us in Akadum Mos. I'm not kidding. Akadum Mos at over 20 words a minute. Time I'd done a few weeks training with them, the marvellous teachers. And Sergeant Eddie Case, just digress. Up till a few years ago, he was still in Catterick. He stayed on the army and actually had it knocked 2 hours into one to accommodate his family. He must be well known up there. He probably, I think he's dead now, I don't know, but he had a large family. And he stayed in the army and he was at Catterick.
In what way was their instruction so good?
They were marvellous at sending Morse. It was I can't explain. Morse was like music. You know, it's hard to explain, but it's something which you either could do and you got better, or you couldn't do it all. Morse code. And we were using international code as well, so that anybody picked the signals up, they wouldn't know you're an army operator. Now, you see, you can tell a wireless operator from his key. Nobody was Morse the same way as anybody else. All different there. Army operators, they could always pick them up. They were very, very staccato, and but we and thought it's like playing music. Really great when we finish up with these lads.
So were there some on the course who couldn't reach the required standard, who had to be got rid of?
Well, what they did, there were two teams formed. One team, there was Squadron Leader Mallory, Major Kay, with the two officers concerned. Major Kay had two wireless operators. One I know was called Lance Corporal Johnny Johnson. I can't remember the name of the other one. The other officer was Lieutenant Alastair Scott. And he had three operators, which is Arthur, Davy, and me. I can't remember the two names, but there were three of us with Lieutenant Scott. And we went all around, you see, and the other two, me and the key, went to Algiers with the Operation Torch, their landing. But we were with the American Army. There was no other British involved. And we landed in about 4 miles from Oran, a little place called Arzu. A-R-Z-E-W, Arzu Beach. And we walked into Oran itself. There was practically no opposition, just fell a little from the Foreign Legion. And the rest of the lads, operators and whatnot, came out to Gibraltar and formed the base station which we worked to, and Algiers worked to Gibraltar and Oran to Gibraltar. That was the idea, and they formed the rest of the force, the base station. And actually, I think it was General, you probably don't know, General Donovan, who was formed the OSS. He put his headquarters on Gibraltar. And we had the base station there, as I say. Didn't last very long, did it? About 3 or 4 weeks we moved from Oran up to Algiers then.
Who was in charge at Oran?
for us.
Yes.
The Lieutenant Scott. And there was only the four of us, you know, so there was. The rest, I was with the American 40, I think it was the 43rd Signal Battalion. 43rd or 42nd. The Americans, anyway, they're all Americans. And we just left them, got word while they go report to Algiers. We was some way around Christmas time, we got to Algiers.
Who did you join there?
We're the busy forming ISSU6.
What does that stand for?
Inter-Services Signal Unit number 6. In Algiers. It's obviously like all the things we use with a code name. The name of the place was called Massagam. But actually it was Villa de Pan at the Algiers right on the coast. You know, the headland out there. And we helped in originally erecting aerials, 60-foot aerials, and making a big radio station, which was going to do the operation to the whole of the Mediterranean then.
Was Douglas Dodds Parker in
yeah.
charge there at North
Dodds
Algiers?
Parker was there, and Colonel Anstruther, who I think became a parliamentary private secretary, or became brigadier. Anstey and Dodds Parker were both there.
Any incidents that happened to you at Oran or Algiers that you can recount?
Nothing at all. Just we were working there, and that was nothing outward. Nothing untoward happened at all. Because we weren't there that all up at the time. Then they just sent me by myself. I was sent up into Tunisia.
Why was that?
They needed a radio operator with squadron leader Mallory.
Who was he?
He is the one who had joined the SOE. He'd come round the school asking for volunteers.
What was his Christian name?
I've no idea. Now, a funny thing, Scott Leader Mallory, according to what I knew, he could speak Arabic and all sorts of things, you know. Now, the day after I arrived at Sajidan, or Sajidan, which is a place in Tunisia, right up near at the front line, you know. The day after, he disappeared. Now they reckon he'd gone into Tunis, his spine at the Tunis, dressed as an Arab. I don't know.